Well, we know it was a historic verdict last week when Alex Jones was ordered to pay close to $1 billion in damages for the 8 Sandy Hook families and an FBI agent who say because of the things he said on his radio show years ago, it impacted them to the point of feeling like they were tormented, harassed. And some of the things that we heard in those testimonies were really hard to hear, but it was the truth. And it was testimony that many of us will never, ever forget. And this morning, we had the incredible opportunity to have attorney Josh Koskoff here, who Josh has come on the show a few times, actually, over the years, talking about his representation of some of the Sandy Hook families. And so I thought it was great timing to have him on and to ask just some questions about this verdict and sort of where we go from here. Good morning, attorney Koskoff. Thank you so much for coming back on the show.
Thank you. Good morning, Melissa.
So first of all, do a quick recap, if you don't mind, for people who may have not gotten all the details. I don't know how that's possible, but if they haven't, what came out last week in court?
I think what came out was the recognition that there's no place in the commercial world for a guy like Alex Jones. He does no good. He doesn't contribute anything. And worse, he uses the most notorious incidents in American history as an opportunity to make money by terrorizing the survivors. In this case, 15 family members of those lost, actually 14, plus an FBI agent who was a hero responding to the scene, who Alex Jones slandered as actors so despicable that they would pretend that their children and loved ones died. And in the FBI agent's case, he was an imposter participating in a government fraud. This led to these individuals not just feeling tormented, but being tormented, harassed, threatened in all walks of life. So if there's no safe haven for any of these people to go, they run into Alex Jones' disciples in the supermarket, in their churches, on the streets. There's just nowhere they can go without feeling that these people are lurking.
And, you know, it's interesting because I've gotten this question before, Josh, and I'm sure you could answer to this as well. People will say, you know, are they even here in Connecticut? Because Alex Jones is really kind of based in Texas. And how much could they have been threatened? Because, you know, they must be coming from all over. And it's interesting because yesterday during the show, I made a quick comment and a comparison to, I think I used the word garbage was what I used. And I was emailed with a series of emails from what looked like a non-recognizable email address, to put it simply. And I knew right away that this was an Alex Jones follower. And it's astonishing because I've worked in news for a long time when Sandy Hook was going on. Obviously, I was in Connecticut and so on and so forth. But like we in the media, we've come in contact with the Alex Jones followers. So I can't even fathom or imagine what the Sandy Hook families, or like this FBI agent, for example, what they have gone through. So they are here. There are Alex Jones followers here in Connecticut. I just wanted to clarify that for people.
Well, he's I consider Alex Jones like a source of a terrible infection, an infection of lies and hatred. And like infections, they cross state lines, imperceptibly. And so the moment he puts something out from his, you know, very elaborate studios in Austin, Texas, it travels around the world at like lightning speed, and it infects people all over America. Robbie Parker and Alyssa Parker moved from Newtown to Washington State to get away from it, and he's been accosted on the streets in Seattle, for example.
Mm-hmm. That was awful.
And Alex Jones's audience, although you know you and I might not listen to him or be influenced by him, he's extremely influential to about, according to him, about 10% of the English-speaking world. So this is no joke. It's not it's not just idle comments that he makes that are unpopular. They're dangerous lies that cause people to do things that they wouldn't ordinarily do to other human beings.
Now, Alex Jones and his attorney have continuously said that the day that verdict dropped of, again, a $965 million verdict against Alex Jones. That was the day that free speech died. What is your response to that?
That's an absolute distortion, and it's despicable. The free speech, the First Amendment doesn't protect lies, period. You don't have the right to lie and slander people. That is not a constitutional right that anybody has, period. And there's no value, I'll add that there's no value to his speech. He's not engaging in thoughtful, if unpopular, political speech. He is lying to gin up the anxieties of his audience so that they will buy his crappy products at steep margins. He charges about $20 for a $4 thing of little beet juice. That's on sale, actually. The list price, I think, is $40 or something like that. So there's no this is not an issue of the First Amendment, and they know it.
So we're speaking this morning to attorney Josh Koscoff, who represents some of the families in Sandy Hook and has been for several years. Josh, is this the biggest payout Connecticut has seen, close to $1 billion?
It's the biggest verdict. It's the largest verdict in Connecticut history, and appropriately so, because this is the most significant damage that's ever been done wrongfully by somebody to so many people in Connecticut history.
How does the jury arrive at such a big number? Like, how did they land on that number?
Well, the number makes would be, I mean, if you were in the jury box, you would have that. It'd be apparent to, but it's hard from the outside, maybe. But by analyzing the degree of harm that was caused to these individuals, by listening to their stories, by seeing their sadness and their pain, with no filters or barriers whatsoever. By listening to these families recount what they've gone through, not just the losses at Sandy Hook, but the immediate stunning aftermath of already being knocked down and underwater, and having this Alex Jones guy, who nobody had ever heard of, put a foot on their head as they were drowning and trying to get up above water. That's how you get there. In the law, the damages are substantial. I think anybody would say that. But the harm, and that reflects the substantial nature of the harm to so many.
We're talking to attorney Josh Koscoff, who represents some of the Sandy Hook families. And we're coming off of a massive verdict that was announced last week against Alex Jones. And we're just asking some very basic questions from this case. For example, we were just talking about how the jury arrived at such a big number. Another question I had for you, Josh, is some members of families got different amounts. So how was that determined? Is that kind of like what you were just saying before? It really depended on what their circumstances were and what they went through? Or like, how did they determine the different amounts?
Well, the jury was asked to assess each person individually, even people within the same family or the same marriage, because their experiences have been different. As you might imagine, their experiences encountering these Alex Jones infected people and the hostilities and threatening and violent nature of them have been different. So, and it probably just was very nuanced, and I was very impressed by that. Actually, it would have been, I think it would have been understandable if they gave everybody, the same amount in a way. But their job wasn't to do that. Their job was to assess each person's testimony and evaluate their own expressions and pain. And even people within the same family, they experience things quite differently sometimes. So I thought it was totally appropriate, and it was actually kind of a beautiful reflection in my mind of the jury working as it should.
Will the families ever see this money, do you think?
The families are going to see as much of this money as Alex Jones has, if we have anything to say about it, and we do. So that's the answer. We don't know. Nobody knows how much money Alex Jones has, because he did not participate or cooperate with the laws that require him to disclose information. And that's what got him into trouble with the court in the first place. So we're going to endeavor to find out how much he has. It was estimated that he had upwards of $1 billion at one point, but we're going to see.
And what happens next? Because there are reports that these families could see even more money, actually.
The amount of money that is going to be recoverable is up to the amount that Alex Jones has, but there will be additional amounts awarded for attorney's fees, which the jury found were appropriate here because of the nature of the wrongdoing and how extreme it was. So instead of having the families pay attorney's fees and costs, the jury assessed those against Alex Jones, again, appropriately so in my view. And then secondly, the judge has yet to award her punitive damages for Alex Jones violating ethical business standards. So that those two things will add to the total amount.
Okay, so just to clarify, actually, because we did get a question about the attorney's fees, that separate lawsuit is so that Jones covers the lawyer fees, the lawyers who are representing the Sandy Hook families.
Right, they cover our fees essentially. That the jury is already, it's not a separate lawsuit. It's within the same lawsuit, and the jury's already decided that there was a question that the jury needed to answer as to whether or not Alex Jones' conduct was reprehensible, such that the families shouldn't have to pay their own attorney's fees, and the jury said yes. And in Connecticut, that's the extent of punitive damages. So it's limited to attorney's fees.
Got
it. At least in that case.
Now,
and then separately, the judge gets to award punitive damages. Sorry, go ahead. And
okay. No, you're fine. You're fine. I appreciate it. Sorry, I have so many questions in my mind, but I appreciate you answering all of them. So how does that work? Like, do the victims get paid first and then the attorneys? Like, if Jones is owing all the money to the attorneys and the victims, do the victims get the chunk of money first and then the attorneys? Or, like, how does that work?
I think we're in a little bit of uncharted territory here because of the combination of things, the size of the verdict, the award of attorney's fees, and the fact that, you know, we're going to have to find out how much Alex Jones has. But, you know, we're going to make sure that the families get taken care of first. You know, we didn't take this case to make money, Melissa. We took it to put an end, to help these families, of course, first and foremost, and then also so that the family's goal of making sure that Alex Jones doesn't do this to any other families who are yet to be confronted with a mass shooting who are out there, because it's going to happen again, you know, so that we put a stop to this, because it's too painful, it's too damaging. And so I think, you know, mission accomplished there. And if we end up eating all of the money that we've spent on the case, so be it.
And Attorney Koskoff, last question, which is probably the lightest one, hopefully, that you'll have to answer this morning. Why was Waterbury chosen as the location for this trial?
Great question. And the answer is it's a complex case. And so there's three complex courthouses in Connecticut, and you list them. And I think we listed Waterbury first because it was closest to Newtown and the family.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, it's funny. I get that question so often, and I always say on the show, I have absolutely no idea. Like, I figured it was because of the manner of this case, and I thought there are certain courthouses that do certain things, and then I didn't know if it was in proximity. I had no idea. So I was like, you know what? I talked to Josh, we'll ask him.
Yeah, no, it's actually, you know, I totally understand why people it's confusing. It's the reason why you're confused by it. But basically, if it was a more of a garden variety case, it would have been filed in Danbury, which is closest courthouse to Newtown.
Okay, gotcha. Well, I appreciate you clarifying that and also taking all of our questions this morning. Attorney Josh Koskoff, thank you so much for your time and your busy schedule for coming on to WICC. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Melissa. Take care.
All right. Talk to you again soon. That is attorney Josh Koskoff of Koskoff, Koskoff & Beter here on WICC. So it's interesting. Business News posted an article recently titled Today's Business, Social Media, Political Speech, and the Workplace. And there's a snippet in there that refers back to something that we've been keeping a close eye on here in Connecticut. It says, let's say an employee of a private sector company posts on their Facebook page that he listens to Alex Jones's radio show. and starts asking people to donate to Jones's legal defense fund because he believes the lawsuits will be protecting Jones's freedom of speech, and they have been violated in the recent defamation trial that was brought on by Sandy Hook families. Angry coworkers complained to employers who believed the position was repulsive, inconsistent with the company's values, and could jeopardize the company's business. Can the company dismiss that employee? So whether it's the Alex Jones situation, politics, there are a lot of controversies surrounding our globe right now. What's appropriate in the workplace? And for that, I wanted to turn to Gary Phelan, who teaches employment law at Quinnipiac University, back on the show this morning. Good morning, Gary. Thanks for being here.
Oh, good morning, Melissa.
First of all, Gary, is it appropriate for people to post to their social media sites things like their political views? And the reason I ask this is because I know it's our own sites. But, you know, we're telling students in high school and college to watch what they post on their social media sites because companies can access it. And it could be the answer to whether they get hired or they don't. So do you think even though you get the job and you've been there a long time, it's appropriate to be posting to your social media sites?
Well, I think, you know, that's how people communicate these days, as I've mentioned in the article. You know, it's like social media has become the new water cooler, you know, or lunch table in the workplace, particularly with many people working from home. That's how they communicate. So it depends on, as to the question of whether it's appropriate, depends on how it's communicated and what's communicated. But, you know, generally it's hard. It's really difficult to say people shouldn't talk about anything related to politics on social media sites.
But what about raising money? Like in this situation where you are raising money for a political party or for an entity that has a lot of controversy surrounding them, what about that?
Well, there's no First Amendment right. First Amendment relates to government action. So a private employer, you know, could terminate an employee who posts something on social media if they don't like it, unless it involves something that is a public concern. Connecticut actually has one of the strongest freedom of speech protections for private employees, but it has to involve something that's a public concern, not just something individually, you know, how it affects them as a person. So, for example, with the Alex Jones matter, you know, hypothetical, the person is talking about the First Amendment. That is a matter of public concern. So this would be generally considered protected speech if an employer couldn't terminate somebody, even though they might not like what was said.
But can they ask that person to take it down? Do they have that right if it impacts the company's image?
Well, generally, no, because, again, the employer can provide certain, you know, guidelines with respect to social media. But when talking about the content of the social media, that's where they're in jeopardy, because it's almost like they're, you know, they're saying, here's what's appropriate and here's what's not. Let's say the owner of the company is a Democrat. So they, you know, if the owner says you can't post anything that's, you know, supportive of Donald Trump, that's encroaching upon their, that there is protected speech under Connecticut law.
So we're talking this morning with Gary Phelan, who teaches employment law at Quinnipiac University, and discussing what is appropriate to be posting online or talking about publicly and what rights employers essentially have when it comes to, I don't want to say controlling it, Gary, but having it under control, if that's a better way of putting it. And the reason I think is because, as I was mentioning in the beginning of this, there are so many controversies, whether it is politics. And of course, I'm in a realm where we have to be unbiased. I mean, in my journalistic approach, we have to be unbiased. I don't like opinions. I like your opinion. I like people's opinions, but I don't like giving my opinion, rather. And we are not really supposed to be affiliated with a political party. That's what, in my understanding, is what news should be. It doesn't mean it's followed, but that's just the way that I run my show. Is that something a company could do, though? Like, so when they're hiring, you know, like you said, so you say you have an employer who's like, listen, we're more Democratic here. It's not to say that we'd like you to be Democratic, but we would like for you to not talk about those things publicly or to tie them back to our company, because we don't want to be seen as a Republican entity or whatever the case may be. Are those things that they could put in the hiring process? Like, can they, I mean, can they pick and choose saying, hey, you know, this is something that we really frown upon and we don't like it being done. We respect that you have a different opinion than we do, but we don't want it to be tied to the company. Is there anything that employers can do in that regard?
Well, that's a good question, Melissa. What they could say is how not to reference their particular company when posting something on social media, but they, an employer really can't say, do not talk about anything that's political or controversial, because, again, that's restricting their protected right to talk about matters of public concern.
So what do you tell your students, Gary? I'm always curious what professors tell their students when they're entering the world of business, especially because it has changed. I'm not sure how long you've been a professor, but it's changed so much even from when I was in college. The biggest concern was don't post pictures of you drinking on Facebook. Like, that was the biggest concern that our professors had when I was graduating college. And I think it's a little more intense in today's world.
Well, I think as a professor, anything I say about, you know, the younger generation and post social media would not be followed. But if they were to follow it, it would be sort of a mix. First, assume that any potential employer is going to be looking at your social media, which, practically speaking, that is the case. And there's nothing prohibiting that. But at the same time, I wouldn't tell students, you know, dictate to them what they should and shouldn't talk about. I mean, these are, you know, privately held in beliefs that are very important to them. So, you know, to censor what you think and what you support and what you believe, I would never do, you know, as a professor.
Well, Gary, I really appreciate your outlook on this. And that you talk about these things, not just with your students, but you share it with us here on WICC. I thank you so much for your time this morning, and I look forward to having you back on really soon.
Oh, thank you, Melissa.
All right, Gary Phelan again, who teaches employment law at Quinnipiac University right here on WICC.
Melissa in the Morning talks with career strategist and workplace expert Julie Bauke. It's Julie on the Job. Now on WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
Good morning, Julie. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great.
Glad to have you here. So, you know, this is a very, very common phrase. You attract more bees with honey than you do vinegar. But what if you just use a net? I love this question. So General Motors, Goldman Sachs, and Tesla, just to name a few, have tried and in some cases have failed to force employees back to the office. And Julie, you and I over the past several weeks have really talked about this struggle employees versus employers have with being back in person versus doing remote work. And there's a question this morning about RTO demands, because it looks like, according to the some of these studies, you know, like, take, for example, GM. So General Motors apparently told employees to come back to the office. There was a lot of pushback. And then they put this mandatory RTO in place for early 2023. Do you think that'll work?
No.
Just nope. And that's the end.
Let me just be clear. So there's this, like, it's sort of like, you know, if you look at employees versus employers, you know, they're speaking two different languages. And employers, let's just, you know, they are completely missing the mark. So when you say they're throwing out a net, catch more bees with honey, blah, blah, blah. And what that means is they are trying everything they can think of to get people back. But what they're not doing in almost every case is actually talking to the people and trying to understand their hesitation and what they might do to allay that hesitation and make it a workplace that people want to come back to. Now, you know, and so there's like, it's I'm just shaking my head, because upper management, let's call them, the higher up people are, I think the more disconnected they are with the people who are actually doing the work. And it's so insulting to say, coffee cart, free lunch on Wednesdays. It's just like you're missing the whole point. You know, people can go to Starbucks. They can make their own lunch. You know, they can, you know, and so that what people want is they want to be heard. They want you to, as a leader, to understand what their hesitation is about coming back in. And it gets down to productivity. They're more productive, and they're happier, and they have a better life. Therefore, they are better engaged and happier as an employee when they're either in a hybrid workplace or they can work from home. And no amount of cinnamon buns is going to change that.
Do you find that that has been sort of the way of incentivizing, is doing kind of freebies or creating like a FOMO, a fear of missing out environment?
Yeah. Yeah. So you're not, it's like there's this, just this stubborn arrogance that says, well, first of all, we know what's best. Number one, we're going to tell you what to do. Number two, we're higher up, we're smarter, we know more than you do. Number three. And that worked with boomers, but it's not working with this generation. And I just read this article where the Microsoft CEO was interviewed about this. And he said exactly what I've been saying, which is you've got to measure productivity. Give people clear goals, measure their productivity toward those goals, and then get out of the way. It doesn't mean that you can't do some events and things in the office. But to try to force everybody back in the office by using these ridiculous sort of gimmicks, it might work once or twice to get people to come in to see the make your own omelet bar, but they're going to get their omelet and go home, you know, so they can get to work. And so the leaders are acting against the data, because the data says in almost every case that the productivity went up during when people were allowed to work from home or work hybrid, and because they are happier with their entire lives, and so therefore they show up better at work. And so it's sort of like you know, you see those cartoons or memes where people cover their ears and go nah 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 nah,
yep.
You know, like you can't
yep.
hear me. That's what's going on, and it's just going to continue until leadership recognizes that they don't have all the answers in this case. And need to engage in conversation, try some things and try some things that see if they work, you know, and get your people involved in the solutions. And that's very hard for people in higher level positions to do.
So we're talking this morning to Julie Bauke, who comes on our show every week for Julie on the Job. She's a founder and chief career strategist with the Bauke Group, which actually her firm helps people land their dream jobs. And that's why we have her on the show here, because she helps people kind of navigate what should be happening, what looks normal in the workplace, what you as an employee or an employer should be keeping an eye out for. So it's interesting, Julie, I remember entering the workforce at 21 years old and being a millennial, obviously. And during that time, it was like the go-to thing to say, oh, millennials are lazy. Millennials move back in with their parents. You know, like millennials are the worst, essentially. That is until the Gen Zs show up. I don't hear anything about the millennials anymore. Now, all of a sudden, we're very like nostalgic and we love, you know, Backstreet Boys. But we were hard workers, apparently. That's what I'm hearing now. But what's interesting it all changes. Every generation is funny. But what's funny is I watched a video, actually, a couple days ago, and I was going to text you because I thought this is a question for Julie Bauke. So I'm watching it and it's talking about what the workplace looks like. And of course, it was like a funny video. It was supposed to be like a comedy video, but it's showing what the workplace looks like based on your generation. And it was so spot on. So the millennial worker is still nervous in nature. They are going to ask you if they could take a week off sometime between January and March of 2023. And I will have my phone on me at all times. Don't worry, I'll still answer emails. It's totally cool. You tell me when I could take time off. That's a millennial worker. But a Gen Z worker will say, I'm taking this week off next week because I have the time. I also did overtime last week, so you owe me two more days. They're a lot more forward and like, listen, this is what I've earned and this is what I'm going to do now. So here's my question for you, Julie, is we've got two very different generations coming up in the ranking. So I know we talk a lot about the boomers, but I want to talk a little bit about the difference in these two up and coming generations, because they're very different. I know for myself as a millennial, I am more timid in nature. It is hard for me to ask for a raise. It is hard for me to ask for time off. But I look at my sister, who's 23, and she has no trouble telling her employee, or her employer, I should say, what's going on. So what does the workplace in the future look like when you've got two very different generations? You've got one generation that, if you are offering me free lunch, that sounds like an incentive to me. If you're a Gen Z, you're like, no, it's not. That's very nice that you're giving me that, but I'd rather get, you know, an extra day off or something. Like, we view the workplace very differently.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about this the other day. I think the gap between the gap of expectations between Gen Z and millennials is much smaller than the gap we're seeing now between Gen Z millennials and boomers. So, I mean, it is the difference I'm seeing in, if you think about the difference in the way a boomer views work, you live to work. You don't really work to live.
Mm-hmm.
And you do what you're told. And in a lot of cases, we've planned our lives around, we'll have fun after we retire. That could not possibly be more different than the way Gen Z sees work. So when you compare the gap between Gen Z and boomers, just in terms of skills and knowledge and attitude and, you know, just all kind and just the way they see work is fitting into their lives, the gap between Gen Z's and millennials is much smaller. So I think
that's
it's
true.
Going to be, yeah, I think it's going to be, there's, you know, there's always some kind of some tussling between generations. And, you know, in the example you used about vacation, you know, you've got, you know, I think there's a very easy way to bridge the differences in how people ask for time off, you know, just by being flexible and open and recognizing that everybody's different, but still having a set of standards that everybody has to adhere to. And but it's still kind of loose and we still want to enjoy our lives. Like the example you described of I'm going to take time off, you know, in January, February for about a week and I'll have all my work done, blah, 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 compared to the old boomer way of I must fill out a form and you must sign it. And then when that time comes, if we have too much going on, I might rescind that. I've been seeing some of that. And boomers
no
be like,
way.
Okay,
is that really,
oh, yeah.
That's really
okay,
happening? Oh, wow. No.
That used to happen.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yeah. And I just, you know, I've been seeing some things lately online where, and this is to me is also an interesting topic where, you know, a Gen Z or millennial will ask for the week off way in advance, get it approved. And then when the time comes, their manager comes back to them and says, well, you know, Nancy wants that week off because she has kids and she wants to take them to Disney World. And sort of that gap between people with kids and people without kids, Gen Z is saying, sorry, that was your decision.
Right.
And so there's just this, you know, this.
But I
this
think naturally a millennial will be like, oh, okay. Like, that stinks, but okay. That's what I'm saying. You know what I mean? Like that.
And yeah.
And as an employer, though, I feel like it is an employer's job to be like, no. Like, here's the thing is, like, that is not okay. And I feel like we have to be aware of it because I think millennials, to an extent, I don't want to say people walk all over me by any extent, but I do think I let things go a little bit easier than maybe people would if you were in a different generation. Like, I will just kind of let things go.
Are you saying that you are more of a team player, would you say?
Well, that's the thing is, I think I'm being a team player. If I'm like, listen, all I was going to do was like go take my kid on like field trips for 3 days. So like, okay, if somebody now needs that time off because of an emergency, like, yeah, I'm bummed, but I'll do it. Like, I wouldn't quit a job over it.
Right,
yeah, I'll
right,
just take other
right.
days. You know, like I don't know. I think that we kind of try to reach a middle ground. Like, I feel like millennials try to reach a middle ground. Same thing with when I take time off. It's the reason I say I'll leave my phone on is because like I don't want anyone to feel like, oh, she just doesn't care. Like, of course I care, but I'm taking time off.
Well, let's remember this too. Gen Z right now, the oldest people in Gen Z are 22 to 25.
So they'll figure it out.
Young.
Right. They're very young.
They're
yeah.
very young. Just think about how you were at 22.
Oh, I was terrified,
I was like,
though. But that's what I'm saying.
Whatever you tell me to do, I will do. So they will, you know, their pendulum is swung all the way toward it's about me. It will level out with some maturity and with some time on job and with some, you know, with some stubbing your toes a few times. And so you know, naturally at 22 to 25, you know, you are more, it's all about me. And they will find a happy medium. And I think that that Gen Z and millennials will get along way better than what we're seeing right now. And the pandemic just amplified it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because
it makes a good point. That, you make a good point.
Yeah. It highlighted the real difference between, and this back to work thing. I mean, this is where it's all coming together in the back in the office. Nope. Come on, please. Here's a coffee. Nope. But they're not listening. They're not asking. They're not, you know, they're just, there's a little bit from a boomer perspective, as I say, of like pounding your fist on your desk and saying, this was good enough for me, so it's good enough for you, or I'm the boss and I say so. And that may have worked with your contemporaries, but that's not going to work with this generation and also young millennials. So you've got to find a different way to lead your organization. It's a non-negotiable unless you want to lose all your people and lose your business.
Yeah, which I don't think anybody does. Julie Bounke, always appreciate getting your perspective. Love having Julie on the job every single week. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Talk next week.
All right. Looking forward to it. Julie Bounke here on WICC.